You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected works of Rudolf Steiner, the title The Bhagavad Gita in the West. This is the second part, the lecture cycle that was called The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita, given in Helsinki. This would be lecture 3, however, in this set it is lecture 8, and given the file I'm creating. Given on May 30th, 1913. In the last lecture, I was trying to show you how the thinking of the present day, which tends to the formation of abstract concepts, is not really a gift of the outer physical world, but a gift of the spiritual world. I tried to show you how fundamentally this abstract thinking enters the human soul in exactly the same way as the revelations of the beings of the upper hierarchies. The point, then, is this, that in our ordinary life we have something in us already that is related to clairvoyant perception. And we have something else in us as well, which is even more akin to clairvoyant perception, although in a less obvious way. I am referring to the consciousness that appears between our ordinary waking state and sleep, our dream consciousness. We cannot become familiar in a practical way with the ascent of the soul into higher worlds without trying to get a clear idea of the peculiar life that the soul leads in this twilight consciousness of dreaming. What then is a dream in reality? Let us begin by considering the dream pictures we have around or before us, which in general are more fleeting and less sharply outlined than the perceptions of ordinary life. These pictures seem to flit past our souls. When we analyze them objectively in retrospect, we may be struck by the fact that in most cases they have some kind of connection with our life on the physical plane. Of course, there are people who are only too ready to see lofty and wonderful things in their dreams, or to interpret them at once as revelations of higher worlds. There are those who really believe that a dream has given them something altogether new, something that has never been there before. In most cases, we shall be mistaken in interpreting our dreams in such a way. In our careless haste, we fail to recognize how, after all, some experience or other we have had on the physical plane, more or less recently, or perhaps even many years ago, has reappeared in the changing, weaving pictures of our dreams. For this very reason, it is quite easy for the materialistic science of our age to reject the idea that there is anything remarkable in the revelations of our dreams, and to point out instead that dreams are simply copies or reflections of what has been experienced in external life. If you are acquainted with the contemporary science of dreams, you will realize that it is always at pains to prove that the dream contains nothing more than the reflections of the physical world stored in the brain. Admittedly, such an attitude can easily deny any higher significance to our dream life by showing that the exalted revelations many people claim to have are pictures characteristic of the age in which they live, pictures that could not have been seen at all in any other age. So, for example, people today often dream in images derived from inventions and discoveries only made in the 19th century. Of course, it is easy to prove that images derived from external life steal their way into the ever-changing play of dreams. Those who would gain a clear idea of their dream experiences, to learn something from them to help them access esoteric worlds, must therefore be exceedingly careful in this realm. They must make a habit to carefully follow out all the hidden connections. By doing so, they will realize that most of our dreams give us no more than was experienced in the outer world. But it is just when we become more careful in analyzing our dream life and every aspiring esotericist should do so, that we gradually begin to notice how one thing or another wells up before us that we could not possibly have experienced in our external life during this incarnation. Readers following the indications given in my title, How to Know Higher Worlds, will notice that their dream life gradually begins to change. Their dreams do actually begin to assume a different character. One of the first experiences may be the following. Perhaps I have been thinking for a long time about some perplexing problem, and have at last concluded that my understanding is not yet equal to solving it, nor is all that I have been able to learn from external sources adequate for solving it. Now, it will not generally happen that I am immediately conscious of having a dream in which this problem is solved for me. Even so, I will be able to have a certain higher consciousness at a comparatively early stage. For instance, awaking from a dream, I will seem to remember something. I can tell myself, quote, I have not been dreaming about this problem, nor was I conscious of a dream I have had earlier. Yet a kind of memory is arising in me. It is as though some being had come near to me who solved this problem for me by giving or suggesting a solution. Close quote. This experience comes fairly easily if one expands one's consciousness by following the indications I have given. One will recall something that was experienced as though in a dream, and will know that at the time one was not aware of experiencing it. Such an experience will seem to shine upward from the depths of the soul, and one may say to oneself, quote, when I wasn't there with my intelligence, my cleverness, when instead I was protecting my soul from the suggestions of my intellect, then my soul had greater power. My soul could come freely, in touch with the solution to the problem, before which my intellect and understanding were powerless. Close quote. Here, too, scientists will no doubt often find it easy to give a materialistic explanation for such an experience. But the one who has had it knows full well that what appeared, emerging like the recollection of a dream experience, reveals something quite different from a mere reminiscence of ordinary life. The whole mood of soul following it tells the dreamer he or she has never had such an experience before. It triggers a wonderful feeling of bliss and elation to realize that in the depths of the soul something more is active than is present in ordinary consciousness. This recognition can become still more distinct, and it happens in the following way. If one carries out energetically the exercises given in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, and if one continues to do so for a long time, even perhaps for several decades, then an experience may arise in the soul quite similar to what I have just been describing. For example, we may recollect an experience in everyday life years ago, perhaps a most disagreeable experience that was felt as a hard blow of fate and could never be recollected without pain and bitterness. Now, something like the memory of a dream arises in our consciousness, but it is a strange dream. It tells us that feelings live within us that drew this bitter experience to us with irresistible force, and welcomed it gladly. Something lives in us that felt a kind of delight in bringing about all the circumstances that led up to this stroke of fate. When we have had such a dream remembrance, we know full well that while in our usual consciousness, which regulates our external affairs, there has not been a single moment, not one in the whole course of our present life, when we did not feel this stroke of fate with bitter pain. Yet, deep down within us, something stands in quite a different relation to this blow of fate. It used all of its power and magnetic force to draw together the circumstances needed to bring about this misfortune. We did not know it at the time. Now we notice that behind our everyday consciousness, another deeper layer of our soul life was wisely at work. If we have such an experience, and we shall have them, if we earnestly carry through the exercises I have indicated, from then onward we will have an extended area of knowledge and conviction. In ordinary life, we feel ourselves in a certain relation to the outer world, and to the events that come to us in the course of our destiny. We meet these events with sympathy and antipathy. In the case mentioned, this particular blow of fate was felt as a bitter and hateful experience. We did not know that all this time our soul had another, wider life, longing to live through what we felt to be so unwelcome. This feeling is quite different in quality from any recollection of ordinary life, for in our innermost being we are very different from what we imagine. It is just this difference that now becomes evident in our soul. It enters in such a way that we know it has brought us revelations from realms into which our everyday consciousness cannot penetrate. It widens our whole concept of our life of soul. We know then from experience that our soul life contains far more than its mere content within the limits of birth and death. Unless we penetrate into these deeper regions, we have no idea that beneath the threshold of consciousness we are quite different beings from what we imagine ourselves to be in everyday life. When a new significant feeling thus arises, the horizon of what we call our world expands into a new region. We realize why it is that in ordinary life we can enter it only under certain conditions. In attempting to describe to you what may be called the esoteric development of dream life, I have set before you two quite different conditions. Our ordinary dream life, which most people experience continually at the border of sleeping and waking, and which is nourished by images of everyday life, and an altogether new world of inner life that can arise steadily through a certain training. We have the power to plunge into the regions of the dream life in such a way as to find a new world dawning upon us, one in which we have actual experiences of the spiritual worlds. However, if we would have these new experiences between sleeping and waking during the night, one condition must be fulfilled. We must be able to exclude the recollections and images of our ordinary life. So long as these interfere in the realm of dreams, they will become inflated and block the way to real experiences of the higher worlds. Why is it that the images from our everyday life thrust themselves so insistently into this higher realm? Because, whether we admit it or not, we have the liveliest interest in all that concerns our particular selves in the external world. If some people imagine that they no longer take any special interest in their life, that makes no difference at all. No one who realizes how in this connection people can give themselves up to the grossest illusions will be misled by such imaginings. After all, people are closely attached to the sympathies and antipathies of their everyday lives. If you really try to carry out the exercises I have given for soul development, you will soon realize that it all comes to this, that you must detach your interest from your everyday life. People carry out the directions given in Title How to Know Higher Worlds in all sorts of ways. Many different people read the book, and for many different reasons. And one's reason for looking into it will determine one's attitude to it. Some may begin reading with the most beautiful feelings of how they may gain insight into the higher worlds. Then their curiosity is aroused. And why, indeed, should we not be curious about this realm? Curiosity often begins to stir, even if one begins with the holiest of feelings. That will only carry through for a little while, however, for all sorts of inner feelings start coming in and make us stop, so we give it up. But the feelings that we do not wish to recognize clearly and generally interpret wrongly are just those connected with sympathies and antipathies. We must free ourselves from them in quite another way if we really mean to carry out these exercises. In fact, we do not free ourselves from them. That is why we stop doing the exercises. Though we say we want to break free of them, we do not do so. But when a person is really in earnest about doing the exercises, the effect they can have is seen very soon. One's sympathies and antipathies toward life change a little. I must say this does not happen very often. When it does happen, the change is of utmost significance, because it means we are struggling against the very forces that allow the images from our everyday life to arise in our dreams. If we have come so far as to alter our sympathies and antipathies in any sphere of life, no matter which one, these forces can no longer find their way in. This alteration in the forces of sympathy need not occur in a high realm of life, but in some domain it must be carried out, perhaps in the most mundane matters. There are people who say they do their exercises every day, morning and evening, and for hours at a time, and cannot go even one step into the spiritual worlds. Sometimes it is difficult to explain to them how easily one can understand this situation. In many cases, they need only realize the fact that they are still grumbling about the same things they were grumbling about 20, even 30 years ago, although they have been doing exercises all of this time. The very language of their grumbling is still the same. Then there are those who try to apply external means that can have certain effects in esotericism. For example, they become vegetarians. But there are people who go about it with utmost seriousness, really attempt to break a habit, yet achieve no results at all despite decades of exercises. Such people will think, if only I could experience a tiny fragment of the spiritual world. It is as if they have returned to the flesh pots of Egypt. For them, as for the Israelites in the desert, longing for luxuries they had left behind in Egypt, the old sympathy for meat has not been suppressed. Others, thinking that they perhaps need meat, may say, my brain needs meat, for the old sympathy for meat was not suppressed. People will come up with all kinds of other reasons, thinking that they perhaps need meat. Let us not imagine that it is an easy thing to transform one's sympathies and antipathies. To quote a passage from Faust, quote, easy it is, yet it is the easy that is hard, close quote. This is an apt expression of the situation of the evolving soul trying to rise to the higher worlds. It is not a question of changing this or that particular sympathy or antipathy, but of changing anything whatsoever. If we do, then after certain exercises, we can enter the domain of dream life in such a way that we bring nothing into it of our everyday sense experiences. Thereby, in a certain sense, new experiences have room to enter. When, through esoteric development, we have really gone through such experiences in practice, we become aware of a certain layer of consciousness in us, lying behind the everyday consciousness with which we are all familiar. In ordinary life, our dreams take place in this second layer of consciousness, in quotes, dream consciousness, but it only becomes such through our carrying into it what we experience from our waking consciousness. If, however, we hold back all of our everyday experiences from this region, then experiences from the higher worlds can enter. These higher experiences are present every day in our surrounding world. When they first arise, we begin to realize that our everyday consciousness itself seems like a dream compared to the reality of those experiences. We find that reality only begins on that higher level. Returning to the example of suffering a blow of fate that subsequently caused such bitter feelings, let us try to understand how one actually comes to realize the beginning of higher consciousness. Along with this bitterness, we notice that something in us sought out this misfortune. We even feel its necessity for our development. Now, for the first time, we realize in practice what karma is. We entered this incarnation with an imperfection in our soul. We felt it deeply, and thus were drawn by a magnetic power toward this blow of fate. By fully experiencing it, we have mastered and done away with the imperfection. That is something real and important. How superficial, then, is everyday judgment in creating a feeling of antipathy toward the misfortune? Here, rather, is the higher reality. Our soul goes forward from one life to another. How short is the time in which it can feel antipathy toward a blow of fate? When it looks out beyond the horizon of this incarnation, it feels one thing only to be necessary, to become ever more perfect. This feeling is stronger than any we have in our ordinary consciousness, which, when confronted by this blow of fate, would have slunk past it like a coward, would not have chosen the compensating necessity. But the deeper consciousness, of which we know nothing, does not do this. Instead, it seeks its destiny, and feels it as a process of growth toward perfection. It says, quote, I entered into this life, I was aware of an imperfection that has been in my soul since birth. If I would develop my soul, this imperfection must be remedied. But to do this, I must go on to meet this misfortune. I must seek it out. Close quote. There we have the stronger element in the soul, compared to which the web of ordinary life, with all its sympathies and antipathies, is like a dream. In that realm of the beyond, we enter a life and feeling of which we can say, quote, it knows us better, it is stronger in us than our ordinary consciousness, close quote. Now we notice another thing. If we really have the experience just described, if we do not merely know it in theory but truly experience it, then of necessity we have another experience at the same time. While we feel we can already enter into those regions where everything is different from what it is in ordinary consciousness, a feeling arises in us, quote, I do not want to enter, close quote. This feeling is very deep. As a rule, the curiosity that impels people to enter the spiritual world is not nearly strong enough to overcome the feeling of revulsion that says, I will not enter. The aversion we feel at this particular stage arises with tremendous force, and all sorts of misunderstandings about it are possible. Suppose that someone has even received personal instructions. He comes to his instructor and says, quote, I cannot get on at all. Your instructions are of no use, close quote. Indeed, he may honestly think so. If the instructor gave him the answer due him, however, he would not be able to understand it at all. This answer would have to be, quote, you can enter perfectly well, but you do not want to, close quote. Because his reluctance remains hidden in his subconsciousness, the pupil honestly believes he has the will to enter. Indeed, the moment one begins to realize this reluctance, one checks it. The idea that one does not want to enter is so horrifying that one immediately begins to damp down one's unwillingness. This reluctance is a subtle and insidious thing. We feel that we cannot enter with the ego, the self that we have acquired in this world. A person who wants to evolve to higher things feels very strongly that he or she must leave this self behind. That, however, is a difficult thing to do, because we would never have developed this self if we did not feel in our daily consciousness that we have this self in order to develop it here. Our ordinary ego has come into this world in order to evolve. Thus, when we want to enter the real world, we feel we must leave behind what we were able to evolve in the ordinary world. Then there is only one way. We must have developed this self more strongly than is required for ordinary consciousness. As a rule, we only develop it as far as needed for ordinary life. Now, if you observe the second point entitled How to Know Higher Worlds, you will find that it amounts to this, that the self must be made stronger than is necessary for the purposes of daily life. Only then are we able to go out of our body at night and still retain something that we have not exhausted. It is only when we have fortified our ordinary self by our exercises and have an excess of self-reliance in us that we no longer want to shrink back from the higher worlds. But then a new and considerable danger arises. We perhaps no longer bring the recollections of ordinary life into our dreams, but we bring something else, our expanded and strengthened self-consciousness. It would be as though we filled that realm with it. Anyone who carries through such exercises as given in my book, and thus comes to have inner soul experiences like Arjuna's, enters the realm of dream life with an expanded, strengthened self. The result is the same whether we have done a special training or were destined to expand the self at a definite period in our life. Arjuna is in this position. He stands at the boundary between the everyday world and that of dreams. He lives his way into that higher region, because through his destiny he has a more powerful self in that realm than he needs for ordinary life. I shall have to elaborate this point still further, showing that Arjuna has this more powerful consciousness, because now, as soon as he penetrates into that realm, Krishna at once receives him. Krishna lifts him out of the self he has acquired in ordinary life, and thus he becomes a different man from what he would have been if his expanded self had not met Krishna. In that case, he would certainly have said to himself, quote, "Blood relations are fighting against one another. Events are taking place that must ruin the ancient holy caste distinctions and the service to our ancestors, events that must corrupt our womankind, and conditions that will prevent us from kindling the fires of sacrifice to our forefathers." Close quote. All of this was part of Arjuna's everyday consciousness, from which his destiny tore him away. He would have had to stand on ground where he would have had to break with all these accustomed feelings connected with old traditions. He would have had to say to himself, quote, "Away with all I hold sacred, with all the traditions that have been handed down to me. I will hurl myself into the battle." Close quote. But that is not what happens. Krishna appears, and what he says must appear to Arjuna as utmost unscrupulousness, as egoism driven beyond all bounds. The excess of force that Arjuna would otherwise have experienced, that he would have used to live through his own life, Krishna uses as a power whereby he makes himself visible to Arjuna. To make this thought still clearer, we may say that if Arjuna had simply met Krishna, even though the latter had actually come to him, he would have known nothing of him, just as we would know nothing of the sense world if we had not received something from the sense world itself that formed our senses for perceiving it. Similarly, Krishna must take from Arjuna his expanded and strengthened consciousness. He must, in a sense, remove Arjuna's self, so that with the help of what he has torn out, he may show himself to Arjuna. Thus he makes from what he has torn out, so to speak, a mirror in which to show himself to Arjuna. We have sought to explain what in Arjuna's consciousness enabled Krishna to meet him. This still leaves unexplained how Arjuna came to his higher consciousness in the first place. Nowhere do we see the statement that Arjuna had done esoteric exercises. In fact, he had not done any. How then is he able to meet Krishna? What was it that gave Arjuna a higher and stronger self-consciousness? We shall start from this question in the next lecture, the end of Lecture 8.